Welcome to the Vet Podcast by the Vet Gurus, Brendan and Mark. Get ready for the latest veterinary news, information and entertainment. Don't forget to visit us at the Vet Gurus website, vetgurus.com. Now, sit back, relax. It's over to the Vet Gurus, Brendan and Mark.
Welcome, Brendan here with Mark. As always, it is the Vet Gurus podcast. Don't forget to visit our website, vetgurus.com. Poke around there, look at some previous episodes, download them, listen to them, become a subscriber, tell your friends, and also say hello to our three main sponsors and go to our Etsy store, etsy.com, and look for Vet Gurus shop and buy some fantastic merchandise. How are you, Mark?
I'm great, Brendan. I'm really, really well.
Excellent. And you're going to tell me about the local birds you have there.
The local birds?
Yes.
What I was going to tell you about was my enthusiasm that where I'm staying here up on Cape York, there is a lot of birds. But what I've recently been reminded of my age. And I wanted to just quickly tell you a story of how stupid I looked. the people with whom I'm staying do quite a lot of trail bike riding. I don't get on those two-wheeled vehicles myself for obvious reasons, for reasons which will become apparent very shortly. But one of them was not going well, Brendan. The spark plug was dirty, and so they were trying to clutch start it. For our younger audience who've never driven a vehicle that has a clutch, that's where you maintain a certain speed. You get a certain rolling speed, maybe going downhill.
You push it, yes, and then you try and start it.
Yeah. That's right, in motion, and you can get the vehicle going. You can do that with trail bikes. And so I was pushing the vehicle, Brendan.
And by my heart in the morning, Mark.
I was pushing it, trying to get it to go as fast as I possibly could to increase the likelihood that that it would start.
And here we go.
And sure enough, it did start. And good Leanne, who was riding the bike, took advantage of the motor having fired to take the bike away. And, of course, I was left momentarily, cartoon fashion, virtually horizontal before I had a rude meeting with gravity and plummeted I suppose it was only 70, 75 centimetres to the hard earth and landed.
Well, on your coccyx?
No, I didn't. I was forward. I was leaning forward because I was pushing so hard. So I landed on my shoulder. The interesting thing was this happened just outside a little crowd of people who were looking at else at the moment. Anyway, one of the 11-year-old young men, asked a couple of people whether I was okay and whether the person that committed the hit and run was going to be arrested.
Oh no! Yeah. Well, they did feel sorry for you, Mark.
So I did get some sympathy. You are correct.
Yes.
I find, to be honest, Brendan, I'm constantly reminded these days of what happens to an aging human body after a certain number of years. I'm on the downhill descent of the cannonball curve of life.
Well, look on the positive, Mark. Just think of all the sympathy you'll get in the future for other events that no doubt will occur due to our aging, Mark. It will happen to me as well, Mark. Yes, yes. I constantly get, I think I've mentioned this before, right? I'm always surprised by when I purchase something in a store or I chat to somebody in a shopping center or wherever, that I often get called, maybe it's a bit of an Australian thing, but I often get called love.
Ah.
How are you, love? Yeah, good to see you, love. Are you okay there, love? So it makes me feel old. Yes. I don't think it's I wish it was, but I don't think it's a chat-up line, that's for sure. So
I think it is definitely a term of affection, though.
Yes. So maybe they, yeah. So it's, yeah. So anyway, we'll leave that there. We won't go any further with that. And I think we want to jump into a couple of news stories. If you like, I'll take mine first. And this was a bit of a sad one, wasn't it, Mark? An ongoing sad news story. Humans are predators of at least one third of all vertebrate species, Mark. So humans prey on more vertebrate species for use as pets and in medicine and other products than we do for food, Mark. And this is an article that is published, or it's on the Scientific American website that we'll link to, Mark. And it's a bit sad, this. It's some really good graphics there, Mark, mentioning which animals do humans use, took the percentage of birds, reptiles, amphibians, and mammals and fish that are used for various things, and then it does break them down to how do humans use these animals, including for clothing, Mark, hunting, sports, specimen collection, food obviously ends up being a fair percentage of it, but also medicine, Mark, and other uses, whatever that may be, and craft, Mark, ornaments such as carvings, etc., and fiber. So I don't know, I found this a little bit depressing. The final paragraph talks about that one of the researchers saying that humans are the Swiss Army knife of predators.
See, I've got a couple of problems with this. I would suggest that the behavior of humans is not predatory. It's preying on animals suggests that you're using them for food. These are utilitarian situations. We are using the animals, but it's indulgent, it's self-indulgent, it's narcissistic, it's to serve often an internal failing. Predation is the wrong word. Humans,
yes.
are not predators of, they're just users, Brendan. They're just users.
Yes.
But it does, the other thing this article raised in my mind is the concept of sustainable use. And this is a topic that's been brought to my mind recently because I've been made aware of a number of studies of reptiles around the world. And we all know those populations, exploding populations of pythons, bull pythons in the Florida Everglades. Reptiles have an amazing capacity for production. And there are a number of places around the world where their use can be sustainably managed. And I suppose that's the thing that upsets me most about this article, that a lot of the use that these animals are put to is not sustainable, Brendan. It's indulgent.
Yeah. And it did state that we capture even more terrestrial vertebrate species for medicine and the exotic pet trade, Mark, than other uses, including food, which I found quite, I knew that, but it is depressing when it's pointed out to you again.
I think the take-home message is, I don't think there's anything wrong with exotic pets, but a small founder population should be taken and only captive bred animals should be distributed widely. You shouldn't be able to keep harvesting those bloody things routinely.
Yep. Well, the final line of the article, I think, summarises your thoughts and probably mine, Mark. We like stuff.
Yes.
What have you got, Mark?
Mad consumption. My one is also a little bit focused on reptiles. It reports... I'm just checking the reference. Oh, I haven't got it here. Yes, Science. In the Science Journal, DNA sequencing helps explain how snakes lost their legs. I love the first paragraph of this article. Snakes are weirdos. Their bodies are typically too thin for more than one lung. They smell, in inverted commas, with their tongues, and most importantly, they have no legs. There has been an extensive effort to sequence the genome of more than a dozen snakes species, and this, combined with other DNA research previously published, has revealed the genetic contribution to leglessness. Talk about hyperbole. Todd Casto, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Texas, who was not involved in the work, he says this research will undoubtedly have a transformative impact on snake and vertebrate biology. Big words from Toddy, I reckon.
Well, Brendan, it's been reported on Vet Gurus, so it's halfway there.
So his prophecy is being fulfilled. Yes, the lead researcher, Jiang Tang Li, herpetologist at Chengdu University of Biology at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, he has identified he was most excited about finding DNA missing from three parts of a gene known as PTCH1, which helps control limb development. Other researchers have implicated mutations in this region, which helps to regulate in other regions, which help to regulate the activity of PTCH1, as possibly being partly responsible for legs disappearing. But now there's a gene that has specifically been implicated. All snakes have the same PTCH modulator mutations, and it is probably one of the most important genetic bases underlying limb reduction in snakes. And this is a little bit weird, Brendan. Lee's team inserted these same mutations in a mouse experiment model, and the mice that were born with that mutation we could make a bunch of jokes. I'm not going to. I'm going to resist the temptation.
Sorry.
But the upshot is they did have much shorter toe bones. So their legs have started to shrink just with that one genetic mutation.
You wonder about the ethics committee approval for that sort of experiment, Mark.
Yes, you do. We do wonder about the ethics approval. And also, I was going to say something I shouldn't say. Look, I think that snakes are weird. They are weirdos. They are exceptional amongst vertebrates in a number of adaptations they have. And the genetic basis of that, how they have evolved, the particular parts of their genome that has been down-regulated to cope with, it seems a fair bit of it is associated with their ancestors' burrowing subterranean lifestyle, but just the way it affects things like their hearing, their vision, the genes that lead them to have symmetrical organs that have been down-regulated. It is fascinating how such extreme genetic wiring is not, you would think that there's a certain point at which such dramatic changes would make a creature not viable. But, have I told you, Brendan, while I've been up here on the Cape, we've been up here for many, many months, and I see, on average, more than one snake a day in the wild up here.
Yes.
So the thoughts about how they got to be the way they are often on my mind.
I don't know where to go from there, Mark. I think you thoroughly enjoyed but detested that study by the sound of things, yes. I think with that, we'll jump onto our main topic, Mark. So Excellent. our main Our main topic you suggested here is, I thought it was pelvic injuries in birds, but it isn't. It is pelvic limb injuries in birds or pelvic limb fractures in specifically, I think. So development and management, how they occur and what we can do about them, how we can prevent them, pelvic limb fractures in companion birds, Mark.
Well, my urge to discuss this topic was triggered by my perusal of the literature and a recent article in the Journal of Avian Medicine and Surgery, where there was a retrospective analysis of pelvic limb fracture management in companion parrot birds by some English researchers, I believe, researchers from the UK. And, I thought that study presented some interesting facts that I thought in the context of how these things occur and what might be done about them and what we should lead clients to have as a reasonable expectation, I thought it would be worth having a talk about, Brendan. So
let's do it.
Yes, let's.
So how common is this?
Well, it is. Pretty common. It's less common in my experience than fractures of the pectoral limb. Obviously, birds are doing forceful things in flight and they've got their legs tucked away when they're doing that. But particularly pet parrots, they tend to do things like sit on swinging cage doors or wander around under people's feet. Impact with stationary objects, even being bitten by cohorts, other birds or other pets in the house, all these things can lead to problems with their hind legs, their feet and limbs. And fractures would be a very common. There's often soft tissue injury, sprain, ligament tears, those sorts of things, but fractures are a very common result of those sort of traumatic events.
So what are the signs, Mark? Do we see obvious signs with these fractured legs, Mark?
That's an excellent question because they are generally pretty obvious. I mean, the birds will not, generally speaking, weight bear on a hind limb that has a fracture, a pelvic limb that has a fracture. They might do it if the fracture is very distal, if that's down in the foot, in the bones of in the tarsometatarsal bones. But they're very likely to not weight bear on that foot. But it may take some time before, you know, because birds have feathers. Because they're resting on a perch, and they will often rest on a perch with one foot when everything's just fine, it may take some time before people realise that the bird's only using one foot and not moving around very much at all. So it is sometimes surprising how long it takes before people realise there might be something wrong with that leg.
So you're saying it's not typical, like we would see in a dog or a cat, for instance, that if they have a broken hind limb, it's the majority of the time it's pretty acute and they bring it into the vet clinic pretty well straight away, don't they?
It is surprising how stoic the birds are and how often they'll have, you know, a serious fracture that they may not necessarily blow up about. They may not vocalize significantly. They exercise that preservation reflex, and people may not immediately think that they've got a problem with that bird.
Yes. So it comes in, it looks a little bit lame. What do we do, Mark?
Well, first thing to do is, as we always talk about, a good thorough physical examination. And obviously it's important to be very careful as you do this, restrain the bird well. It is, in my experience, very easy to be overly vigorous and have the fracture fragments cause additional tissue damage as they flop around. Those hind limbs have like relatively large feet on them, and so they can have a little bit of a pendulum effect. If you rock the bird over on its back and the leg flicks over and the foot weighs quite a lot, then there can be a lot of movement at the fracture site. So just very careful handling as you perform that physical examination. And particularly the ones that I find that are most difficult, the fractures that are most difficult in the hind leg are the high ones, of course. There is very little soft tissue down distally, and so you can often see significant derangements in position and orientation. But those femoral fractures, particularly high femoral fractures, they're very difficult to tell about on physical examination. You may get a sense that something's wrong. You may even be lucky enough to feel some crepitus as the bird tries to move the leg, but often you don't, and they're often dependent on radiographic assessment, Brendan.
And speaking of radiographs, yes, my next question was, what is your standard workup for these?
Well, I think almost invariably, I need to anaesthetise the bird to have a more detailed exam. I do need to make a little bit of an assessment of the amount of tissue damage, that there is sometimes where both the nature of the injury and the time since it's happened has led to significant circulatory compromise to the area of the fracture, and sometimes those fractures might not be suitable to go ahead with because of that, the tissue viability, the blood flow, all those things that are likely to speed healing. If they're compromised, then sometimes it's not appropriate. So assessing the fracture, assessing whether the wound is open and exposed and there's evidence of secondary contamination, possibly even infection. And then, of course, the bird needs to be radiographed. And I think this is one of those situations. For many emergency bird radiographs, we're lucky that we can get radiographs of the whole bird, generally speaking. You do want to get several views. More than once, I've been foolish enough to work on a bird that I have not got multiple views. And, of course, if you go down a surgical path there are concealed aspects to the fracture that you might not have picked up if you didn't take at least three views. You can be made to look very foolish at the time of surgery as everything falls apart and your surgical plan doesn't serve the interests of the patient.
Supportive care, Mark. What do we do while we're doing all these workup techniques and thinking about how to repair that fracture?
Well, the key things are apply equally amongst all our small exotic species. Make sure they are pain-free is the first one, because they're going to be much easier to manage in terms of nutritional status and hydration status if we've got a bird that's relatively pain-free. So paying very, very high priority attention to analgesia in the first instance. And then, of course, most birds will come in because their mobility has been decreased, because there's a degree of pain and probably nausea, I'm assuming. They will be dehydrated and maybe a bit hypoglycemic. So energy-rich fluids and food to start with, a safe, warm place. Such animals are often thermoregulating very poorly, a nice, dark, protected hospital enclosure that's thermally supported while we stabilise the animal is a good way to go.
Of course, you've summarised that beautifully there, Mark. What about our treatment options? Maybe jump over to, you've referenced that particular article there, Mark. It has a good little summary of the outcomes there. Do you want to chat about that?
So we're talking here about the table 3 on page 168 of JAMS, and the fixation method they were talking about here included the external. They first of all talked about cage rest, and I think this is a really important one to canvas, that there are fractures, particularly some of those femoral fractures in particular patients, that it is a perfectly reasonable course of action to be aggressive with your pain relief, provide an excellent supportive cage, an enclosure, and have the animal restricted in its activity levels for several weeks. That's not, provided you're paying attention to levels of pain and nutritional and hydration support, that's a perfectly reasonable course of action in some cases. I often using external skeletal fixators, and particularly more frequently these days, I'm using the tie-in fixator, one where an intramedullary pin is placed down the long axis of the bone, comes out at one end, is bent at two right angles to create a parallel connecting bar, and then several, depending on the nature of the fracture, several fixator pins of some sort or another are inserted to hold the various fracture fragments in place. That's probably the most frequent surgical intervention I would use on the pelvic limb. There are a number of external coaptation, forms of external coaptation. I was talking to you before we came on air about the Altman splints, one of my favourite types of external coaptation. There's also commercially available aluminium foamed back splints. There's a number of commercial splints available for various birds now of various sizes, and these can be used as an additional, you know, supportive measure if you can't make a cast or splint up yourself. Probably the last one to talk about amongst potential treatments is amputation. Now, I would, generally speaking, Brendan, I would not amputate routinely the weight-bearing hind leg of most parrots, even though they are better maybe than, you know, ducks or many other birds. It's still a real risk that they're going to develop pressure sore problems in the remaining leg if they don't have both legs. The extra weight that leg has to carry all the time is likely to be problematic. But in certain cases where the leg with the fracture is, you know, its viability is compromised, an amputation is a reasonable thing to do. But it's important to let the clients know that with that amputation is going to come a lifelong, you know, managing the perches so they're softer and oriented so that they don't put additional pressure on the bird's foot, and a whole bunch of additional things that can be done to limit the chance of the development of pressure sores and bumblefoot.
Now, Mark, a quick question.
I love your quick questions.
Talk a little bit about bone healing in these.
Whew, a little bit about bone healing. It's a good topic to talk about, I think, Brenda, now, good old bone healing, because, just let me, I'm flicking through some notes I have here, but it's, I think it's really important that we do continually refer back to these basic things as we're looking at, you know, the general principles of fracture healing. Those general principles, they apply across a range of species. And while there's some differences when it comes to different species, and the peculiarities of each species are what sort of sets us unusual and exotic Canadian vets apart, Those general principles are good to just review at each stage. And probably one of the critical things about birds, about avian bones compared to others, is that they do tend, because the bones are designed for flight, they have a very, very hollow medullary canal, and these may be connected to air sacs, which once again plays a role in your surgical plan. And the cortex of the bone may even have more calcium in it per weight than when compared to many of the terrestrial animals, just to increase the strength to weight ratio of the bone. The consequence of this is that those bones are a little bit more brittle and tend to shatter a little bit more easily. So someone used to handling, you know, a rabbit or guinea pig bone might be surprised at the way that what we could do to those other little bones, we need to be a little bit more careful, and we can't do as easily with our bird bones.
Well said, Mark. Put under the pressure there, but well said. Now, complications, Mark, and I think there's a bit of a summary of that in that particular article, and I think I expect that similar sort of complications are encountered worldwide, Mark, with repair of these pelvic limb fractures. Do you want to briefly
go through those? This is one of the, I think, key take-home messages I'd try and take out of this paper, and that is that there are complications. So two facts before we talk specifically about complications. The first one is that well over, I think it was 85.7% of the birds that were treated went on to make a complete recovery. So well over 4 out of 5 birds are going to heal up. So it's good to communicate that to your clients. Interestingly enough, nearly half the birds had some form of complication during the process of healing. And my big take-home message is that those complications were much more common in the birds that had external coaptation. Now, certainly the birds that have, for example, a tie-in fixateur, some birds will, you know, particularly some parrots, will have a go at that structure, and that might be a significant complication. Though in my experience, appropriate placement of the pins and appropriate levels of analgesia will generally lead to the circumstance where the birds leave it alone. But external coaptation is certainly overrepresented when it comes to the forms of fixation that are likely to lead to complications. And this is probably, when communicating with clients, I know my clients, for example, they definitely have a cost structure in their mind that, here we go, external coaptation is going to be much cheaper than a surgical repair. Mark loves his surgery and he loves charging for it. So if I can get a splint or some form of cast put on this, that's going to be much cheaper. But in actual fact, because of the incidence of complications such as rubs and sores and the fact that the area healing is often concealed and maybe there's a non-union or possibly even an infection at the site of the fracture, overall, the cost of treating a fracture with external coaptation can and regularly is as much as a surgical correction, because of the additional anesthesia, because of the extended healing time, because of the need to sometimes even completely repeat the placement of the cast or splint, there often isn't any saving. And so clients looking for a less expensive way out may be under a false apprehension that a cast or splint is going to be cheaper for them, Brendan. You've muted yourself again.
Some very wise words, Mark. Very wise words there.
You give me the biggest scare when you mute yourself and don't come back, because I think, oh my goodness, I've been talking for 5 minutes and the link has dropped out and I've said all these semi-useful things and we won't be recorded. But yes, I'm glad that
we did get it
on the tape.
All good, Mark. So complications, yes. Assuming we have a resolution of the problem there, Mark, I think we should briefly mention, and you did touch on it at the start of this topic, prevention. How do we stop these occurring in the first place?
Well, I think the key thing is to be aware of the traumatic circumstances that they're likely to occur in, that I find many of the bird owners I talk to assume that their birds themselves are going to understand the risks. And my experience is the birds don't have any clue. They don't comprehend the nature of the problem at all. And so they will put themselves in dangerous positions. They will sit on the top of doors. They make excellent perches, whether they be human doors or cage doors, avoiding training the bird to be happy about that is a good thing. Being aware of other pets, we've talked in other podcasts about the way that cohabiting animals may be seen as, inverted commas, friends by their human owners. But for many reasons, it's often not good to let them wander around together. And behaviors, aversive behaviors, attempts at aggression inappropriately made between birds and dogs, for example, may result in these sorts of traumatic events where a dog reflexly snaps. And so just being aware that these things can happen, talking to our clients at those, this is a good topic to talk about at those annual exams. I think it's a good thing to have a series of these topics that you talk about that preempt a problem. And it also means that for the client, their visit, whether biannual or once every year, you get a chance to talk about something different while you do your physical exam and draw your blood for a health assessment. But talking to clients before it happens about the risk, making them aware, definitely the best way to prevent them.
Have you seen many birds with these breaks where it is the owner that's either accidentally treads on them when they've got the bird out, falls over on them, lies on them on the couch, rolls over on them if they've got them sitting in their bed with them? Do you see many of them
occur that way? Yeah, yep, definitely. And all sorts of traumatic injuries can occur from these I think a lot of clients treat their birds like the birds know what the risks are and will only behave in a way that minimizes them, and the birds definitely don't do that. So they will crawl into the bed beside you thinking that's a nest spot, and they won't realize that there's the potential to be rolled on and squashed. And they definitely get pelvic limb fractures. They definitely get wing fractures or pelvic, not just the pelvic limb, but the pelvic bone structures. You could imagine all the sorts of things that could happen when they get squashed in those circumstances. And so treating them as birds and not little people is a very good thing to do.
Wise words, Mark. Wise words. Any final comments about these limb fractures, pelvic limb fractures in birds?
Look, the final take-home message was that the outcome for most of these was excellent. And so they are certainly ones that I would encourage people to do their work up, get an appropriate plan in place, surgical or otherwise, and get in and repair them because they do tend to go well in my experience.
Oh, Mr. Outro's here, Mark. We're out of here and we'll talk to you all next week.
Thanks for listening to the Vet Podcast by the Vet Gurus. Don't forget to visit us at the website vetgurus.com, where you can subscribe, view show notes, listen to previous episodes and more. You can contact us via email at vetgurus@gmail.com to ask a question or just say hi. Thanks again and see you next time.